Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, Jonathan Levine, the writer-director of the highly praised film The Whackness, and Kurt Kinney, the director of the year's most moving documentary, Dear Zachary. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United. United. This is Jamie, and Jerry's here with us tonight. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, what's up?
Excited to bring you the show tonight. Like we said at the top of the intro there, we have Jonathan Levine tonight. His independent film, The Whackness, premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and it's received raves, and it gets a theatrical release starting this week, July 3rd, I believe is the date.
Yes, July 3rd.
And,
yes.
And also we're going to be welcoming Kurt Kinney, who anyone that's listened to the show since early in the year knows how much I feel about his latest documentary effort called Dear Zachary. It's pretty much the most moving experience I've had in the cinema this year, and I can't wait to share that with you in the last half hour of the show. How you been, Jerry?
I've been very good. How are you doing?
I have been well. I've been well, and we're also going to be discussing, you know, you check out everything under the sun every weekend, so we're going to be discussing.
We'll talk about that for a little bit. I've written enough about them that we'll talk about them. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Sure,
we got to pay him some lip service at the end of the show here. All in all, a great weekend for good movies. You know,
I would say this is one of the better weekends in a long time, at least for me. The two that I saw, Wally and Wanted, you know, couldn't really ask for a better day.
Yeah, big dumb summer fun. I'm talking about Wanted.
Nothing
wrong with that. That's great.
No, absolutely not. Nothing at all.
I want to let everyone know this Wednesday night we have a special show as well. We're going to welcome the author of a book called Producing with Passion, Tony Lavelle, and also the creator of one of the most landmark series of the past, 20 years has to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's the show of the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. And the director of the upcoming X-Files 2, Mr. Chris Carter, he will be with us on Wednesday night. So that should be an exciting show, too. Are you ready to get started tonight?
Let's do it. Let's go.
Okay, The Whackness, I love that title, is a critically acclaimed film with the year's most eclectic cast, including Sir Ben Kingsley, Famke Janssen, Method Man, and Mary-Kate Olsen. The stunning work, which won this year's Audience Award at Sundance, comes from writer-director Jonathan Levine, whose previous effort, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, took the festival circuit by storm 2 years ago. Dwayne Burge of The Hollywood Reporter says The Whackness bursts the form of the rite of passage summer yarn, and critics and festival audiences all across the country agree, as they have taken it into their hearts like no other film this year. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer-director Mr. Jonathan Levine to Movie Geeks United. Jonathan, are you with us?
I'm here. How you doing, man?
I'm great, man. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Tell me first of all, before we get into The Whackness, tell me what inspired you to become a filmmaker? How early in your life did you know that you were destined to do
God.
This?
I think, camera.
Yeah. So how old were you when you...
Well, can you hear me?
Yeah, your cell phone's breaking up just a little bit.
Yeah, we can barely make out...
How's this? Hello?
That's great.
Okay. When I was 12, actually, and then throughout kind of my high school, I kept doing it, and then studied it at undergrad, and then studied it at grad school. So since I can remember,
What were you kind of initial inspirations in the world of film?
Some of the independent film of the early 90s, especially, whether it's Spike Lee or Todd Haynes or Steven Soderbergh.
Right.
And then... like the first time I saw Breathless was kind of a revelation. I saw it in the high school film class I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All that, and then Taxi Driver and Manhattan, Woody Allen's Manhattan.
You can't beat those.
Yeah, you really can't. Those are good influences.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you know, I tried. I mean, like as a kid, when I got the video store in New York delivered, so that's when I got really into watching that stuff on VHS.
Oh, they deliver. Oh, lucky you.
Yeah.
So you said you attended film school. Where'd you go?
I went to the American Film Institute out in California.
Oh.
That was right after, probably 2 years after college. I was living in New York, and I decided that, you know, if I wanted to be a filmmaker, I was just going to have to figure out a way to make movies, just because, you know, the other occupations I was doing weren't getting me close enough
right.
to the production process. So, for me, it was a great experience.
I'm reading in your bio here, and this is fascinating to us because we've had the pleasure of welcoming this gentleman on the show, and we've paid tribute to him on the show before too. I understand you were a personal assistant to Paul Schrader during Autofocus.
Yeah. Has he been on the show?
He's done our show. Yes.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
We're amazed too.
Yeah, we are too. Don't worry.
Tell me about that.
So, you know, well, for me, it was just like, it wasn't, I didn't have the most responsibility, you know. I was getting him coffee. I was you know, making sure he made it to his appointments on time. But just the ability to kind of be there, and you know, just from listening to his conversations, or every once in a while when he was writing, he would type things on his word processor and hand them to me to translate into final draft form. Or even when he was not in the office, I was just looking through his files and seeing like handwritten pages from Taxi Driver or Raging Bull. But for me, it was really interesting just to kind of see someone of his stature and his experience and kind of how he handled the business. And I think for me, it's a great example. He's a cool guy.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Very much so. When we were talking to him too, I mean, he's every bit the writer, because he spoke so eloquently.
Yes, he did.
He is amazing.
Very funny too. Very funny guy.
Yeah, very much so. So you had made some short films prior to Mandy Lane, correct?
Yes. In film school, I made a couple shorts. I did my thesis film entitled Shards. Was sold to HBO, so that was good. And then after that, I did a short documentary where I ran around the country on internet dates and filmed myself on internet dates.
Yeah.
So those were my two shorts.
So, but did they lead at all to you procuring the job at Mandy Lane, or?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily the one where I filmed myself on internet dates. It didn't really lead to Mandy Lane, but the one my thesis film certainly helped get me Mandy Lane. I mean, what got it really for me was my relationship with the producers just from film school. And then they showed my short to the financiers who thought it was good and wanted to give me the opportunity, I guess. So without that, I don't think they would have gone for it.
Yeah. Well, I know you've been asked this over and over again. So, but I'm gonna make it like the millionth and first time that you've been asked it. I mean, this film, I have been waiting for it and waiting for it. Mandy Lane. All the boys love Mandy Lane.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of
okay.
took the world by storm like 2 years ago in the festivals. When are we going to see it?
Yeah, where is it?
It's somewhere, man. I don't exactly know. I kind of, you know, the release date has changed so many times that I kind of separated myself from it mentally. You know, when it's about to come out, I'm hoping that they'll let me know, and then I can do my best to promote it. But for now, I'm sort of just taking a wait-and-see approach. I think they're trying to find a release date. I saw that there was a poster online the other day that I thought was pretty cool. But I'm
they've
not really...
With, yeah, they've had
I
like four,
too,
four
yeah.
different poster designs for it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's, you know, it's not... It's really not something I know that much about. It's changed so many times that I'm so hesitant to talk about it, you know? I'm just...
Yeah.
It just makes me really glad that you know, we made the Wackness, I guess, less than a year ago, and the fact that it's come out so quickly, I'm very grateful to Sony.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. But at the same time, is it frustrating for you? I mean, you said you've had to mentally separate yourself. Is
yeah,
it because
I mean,
it's kind of painful for you that your baby, you know, hasn't seen the light of day yet?
Certainly, you know, but less so for me than for, you know, my collaborators, because I've been able to kind of be fortunate enough to make another movie, and not all of them have. You know, they're wonderful actors in that movie and wonderful crew who should be able to use it as a calling card, and they can't yet. But
right.
hopefully, And, you know, not to mention the fact that I think an audience would really dig it. So, yeah, I'm a little, you know, it's just a little strange, you know. But I think as far as this coming out, like Wagner's coming out first, I think it's cool because it's, you know, it's definitely very reflective of my personality and of you know, sort of my own experience. So I kind of like it as well as an introduction to an audience in a way.
Yeah, tell me about the Wackness. What first of all, tell me about the basic premise.
Basically, it centers around a kid named Luke Shapiro, who's a young high schooler / drug dealer growing up in New York in 1994, and the relationship he forms with a psychiatrist played by Sir Ben Kingsley, in which they trade marijuana for therapy sessions with the psychiatrist.
Right.
And Olivia Thirlby plays Kingsley's stepdaughter, and Josh Peck, who plays Luke, falls for her. And it's just, you know, all these people trying to sort of navigate their relationships in one hot summer in 1994.
So is this a particularly autobiographical film for you? I mean, does it feel very personal to you?
I mean, it's personal, you know, without being autobiographical, if that makes sense. You know, nothing in it really happened to me, but definitely the spirit of this kid and the way he looks at the world and the music of the time and
right.
The kids he was hanging out with, all that stuff is, you know, directly from personal experience.
Right. Excuse me, Mr. Levin, what made you set it in that time period? What, are you nostalgic for that period?
I mean, for me, I think that that's the period where I came of age, you know, and I really, you know, it's a genre I really like.
Okay.
And if I were to try to write high school kids today, I think it would come off as, like, pretty false.
Right. No, I understand that. Trust me, I understand that completely.
And so, you know, once I started writing it, I just started writing it kind of from my own kind of personal life, and then I started thinking about it, and it was, you know, whether it's the music of that year or
right.
Giuliani becoming mayor or Kurt Cobain's suicide or the OJ
right,
trial,
right.
All that stuff was happening in that year. And, you know, I found it to be kind of an exciting backdrop.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is interesting. This is what Jerry and I were discussing earlier today. I mean, it's set in 1994, I believe, which is the year you graduated. Is that correct?
Yeah, yep.
And we're curious because – you know, we see the film set in the 80s and 70s and before, and each of those decades kind of had their own character or their own identity.
Right.
And I'm wondering what's your viewpoint of, what's the character or identity of the 90s for you?
Well, I think, you know, for me, it was set a lot by the music.
Right.
I think, you know, you have hip-hop starting to cross over, and this is just, of course, like my own personal perspective. I don't think yet the 90s has had a kind of defining, you know, like when you think of the 90s, there's nothing specific you think of, whereas when you think of the 80s, I think of like Flock of Seagulls or something, you know?
Right.
So like, but you know, it's interesting, I think, because time sort of moves so much quicker these days to look at it and juxtapose and start to hopefully like help form whatever that may be, you know? We tried to include a lot of funny references from the time and a lot of things that I remember. But, yeah, I don't think it yet has that kind of defining thing, although VH1's starting to help.
Yeah, I think the first half of the 90s, half of the 90s does, because you do have the arrival of, or I guess the second, like, big wave of independent American film, and also the arrival
right.
of grunge. I mean, it's very important.
Right.
I don't know, the second half is like a blur, because it just becomes so many things with the arrival of the internet.
Right.
It becomes
well,
all
that, the... Yeah, exactly.
But the
it.
First half is where your movie's set. There's definitely hip-hop and grunge. I mean, two major musical forces that
yep.
take over the landscape.
Yep. No,
yeah,
absolutely.
And see, I was still listening to Barry Manilow in the 90s. So
but he's a mainstay every decade, Jamie. He's a mainstay.
I just rediscovered him, so that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Tell me about this cast, because this is an amazing cast, and I understand
yeah.
that Sir Ben Kingsley signed on first. Was he something
yeah.
that an actor you had in mind as you were crafting this role?
I mean, not exactly. It wasn't written for him. We certainly had, you know, a very long list, because that's just what you do when you do something like this. We would have no idea if it was something he would take seriously, but he was the first one we went to. And luckily he read it really quickly and responded to it. But no, I mean, I never thought I'd have the opportunity to work with him. And then, you know, now I just can't imagine anyone else in the role.
Yeah, I saw an interview with him the other night, and he seemed so enthusiastic about his craft. Tell me what it's like to direct him. What does he need from a director?
Well, first of all, he doesn't need much. He's like an incredibly vibrant, charming, outgoing, and smart human being. What I did basically at the beginning of the process was I just kind of asked him how he likes to work. And he said, I mean, he has a couple things. He said, you know, I'm really good on the first two takes, and I might not be so good, and then I'm going to get it back on, like, the fourth, fifth, sixth take. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that it was an independent movie and we'd probably usually only get three takes. But, and then the other thing he told me was just to tell him when I felt I had something that we could move on with, and then to give him another couple takes beyond that so that he could play with it a little bit more. Because he adhered to the text, like, quite strictly. But then every once in a while, when I said we had it in the can, he would keep going, and sometimes amazing things would happen. But beyond that, I think my job with Sir Ben was just sort of to create an environment that's really comfortable and friendly to him, and then just kind of stay out of his way and not jump in where it's not necessary. Because the guy's pretty good, you know?
He's beyond pretty good.
Not much you really need to tell him.
Right, right. But also your, you know, your other lead actor, who's being acclaimed as a newcomer, even though, I mean, he's got a lot of credits under his belt, but this is probably his big arrival in this film. Josh Peck?
Yeah.
Tell me about what qualities stuck out from his audition that you'd been searching for from that character.
Well, when he came in, is it windy, guys? You hear
just a little bit. Just a little bit. It's okay.
Okay, I'm gonna go hide under a storm. Anyway, when he came in, it was, you know, very apparent to me right away that he was the right person. It was just, and I had never seen Drake and Josh. I'd never, I'd not even seen Mean Creek at the time. So, but he came in and he just had this wonderful combination of authenticity. You know, he felt very. It felt very accurate to me, his portrayal. And then beyond that, he also had sort of a vulnerability to him and an ability to engender empathy in an audience that you know, I think made him perfect for it, because that's sort of what the movie's trying to do on a macro level, sort of be very specific yet accessible from an emotional level, and not
right.
So specific that it sort of shuts people out.
Right, right. And in terms of that relationship between, you know, I'm wondering as a screenwriter, what you were trying to flesh out from that relationship between he and Kingsley. What do those characters give one another?
Well, I mean, I think it came from the fact that I saw a lot of adults in my own life kind of not behaving like adults, sometimes behaving more immature than the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of liked the idea that you can come of age at any time. And I think, basically, maybe I'm starting to embrace the fact that the Kingsley character might be me in 20 years, although it really scares me. but, you know, that was sort of, in writing him, that's just like you let your kind of imagination run wild. He's so much fun to write. And there's no real person in my life who he's based on. So
right.
The only thing I can assume is that in 20 years I'm going to be crazy like him. But beyond that, I think, you know, I really like the idea of this parallel relationship and these two kind of lost souls at very different stages in their life, yet who still seem to need to learn the same lesson.
Right.
I have a question from the chat room from Joel for you, Jonathan. And
yes.
What was it like directing Method Man and the other professional actors? Because he heard the rappers are very good at memorizing their lines. How was directing Method Man?
Well, Method Man for me was that was an incredible experience, just because of all the actors, and I got the opportunity to work with a lot of great ones. He, for me, is like the one who intimidated me the most, because that was the music I was listening to. I still listen to his music. And he's just an icon, you know. I've seen him.
Right, absolutely.
So, but he was super cool. I think that's actually the really nice thing about this film is we could have ended up, I don't know. I feel like sometimes, you know, actors of that measure aren't cool, but each and every one of them was so nice and personable, and we just had such a great vibe on set. And Meth especially was great, because, you know, he really committed. Like, he got he got a dialect coach to get the Rastafarian dialogue right.
Right, right.
And he it's just kind of amazing, like standing behind the monitor watching Method Man pass a block to Ben Kingsley.
That's a dynamic. I mean, that's dynamic, right?
Yeah,
there.
You don't see you don't see that often. So yeah.
No.
Well, so tell me, the film is released. Is it released limited on July 3rd? Is that correct?
July 3rd, New York and L.A., and then kind of each weekend thereafter, we're going wider. And so hopefully people check it out. It should be going pretty wide, I'm hoping.
Well, the response has been fantastic, and it all started with the Sundance experience. Tell me about that. That had to have been crazy.
Sundance is very intense, you know? And in many ways, it's got incredible highs, and then sometimes I got a little freaked out just because you're taking your movie there not just as, you know, a creative piece, but also as a piece of commerce. And so there's, you know, for me, I was stressing, like, are we going to sell it? You know, are the people who paid me going to get their money back and stuff like that? But, you know, when the lights go down and you're sitting there watching it with an audience for the first time, all that stuff goes away. And that's really, for me, what it's all about. And we left with the audience award, which was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, to know that we made that sort of connection with an audience is really incredible.
Yeah, that has to be the most satisfying aspect of it. I mean, you set your, like I said before, you set your baby out there, and to have it so well received, that has to be very satisfying for you.
Oh yeah, you know, and then when the first time people sit down, I have no idea. Like,
none of us do.
Yeah.
You know, it's so scary, and then to have that happen, it was just, you know, one of the most amazing moments of my life.
So I'm wondering from you, you know, this is your second feature film, and you're working with top rank actors. And that has to make you up your game. What lessons has this Wackness experience taught you? What are you taking away from this experience?
I mean, I think, you know, what I continually learn is to be as prepared as possible. And to, you know, on this movie, I made shot lists and I did overhead diagrams with my DP, stayed up till all hours in the night. And I just like to make sure to continue to do that. And I think the biggest lesson I learned, though, is from Kingsley, because he just set this amazing tone on the set of professionalism and of respect, and I think, you know, it was he's a great example for someone of that stature and that experience level to be, you know, standing in when other actors are doing close-ups and feeding them lines. He doesn't have to do that, and he's just just how he is, though. And so I think that's another lesson I learned, is to always be respectful of your collaborators.
You know, that's time and time again, the more people we speak to, that seems to be a common thread. You know, the greatest artists tend to be the most generous collaborators.
Absolutely. And generosity is a great word, because being generous doesn't just mean, generous of spirit, but also generous in scenes where, for instance, that's another thing Sir Ben said to me, was that in his scenes with Josh, he asked me to make sure Josh knew that he was sort of leading and guiding the scenes, because he wanted their on-screen relationship to mirror their off-screen relationship. Their off-screen to mirror their on-screen. And so, you know, for the first couple weeks, Josh was leading all the scenes, and then they sort of handed them off a little bit. But I think it's incredibly generous of him to sort of give the lead in these scenes to Josh.
Yeah. Do you have ideas brewing for another project?
I'm adapting a spy novel called Echelon Vendetta right now into a script, and that's pretty cool. It's kind of like Born Identity on acid. and then I got a few things kicking around, a few ideas kicking around, and I'm also reading other scripts that other people wrote to direct. But basically, for the last 3 weeks, I've been going like coast to coast, going door to door, trying to spread the word about this movie, because it's, you know, I've invested my heart and soul into it, so I just really,
oh yeah, man.
Oh, I understand.
I've been trying to get the word out, and so then I'll take a deep breath and I'll start writing something again, I think.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with the Wackness Man. I know it's going to be a huge success for you.
I can't wait to see it.
And please,
thanks,
please
so
come
much.
Back and come back and tell us, give us updates about Mandy Lane and any future projects. We'd love to have you back on.
Oh yeah, please do.
All right, fellas. Thanks so much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
Thank you, Jonathan. Bye-bye now.
All right. Take care, guys.
All right. That's Jonathan Levine, the writer-director of The Wackness. Really top shelf movie. I mean, this is an independent filmmaker that he's got it made. He's got it down.
He just sounds that way.
Yeah.
Do we have time? Do we have a couple? Do we have a minute or so?
Yes.
Okay, I would kick myself if I did not plug Horror Movie Fans show tonight. Do you know who they have on tonight?
Who do they have on?
They have Mr. Disgusting from BloodyDisgusting.com, and this is going to be a huge show. I guess this gentleman is going to be responding to an editorial that I believe Mike made a couple weeks ago about Platinum, their Bloody Disgusting's relationship with Platinum Dunes. And let's just put it like this: it should be an explosive show.
Any guest with the name of Disgusting, yeah, that's explosive right there.
but I think I'm under the impression of this, because as far as I know, Bloody Disgusting is like one of the first big horror film, horror-related websites on the Internet. So this should be very interesting. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. So that airs when?
That's at 10 o'clock tonight.
10 o'clock tonight. I know they just posted the link.
Yeah.
Let's talk. While we have a couple of minutes, we have... Let me see how many minutes we have. We have three minutes or something.
We can get a lot done in 3 minutes.
Yeah. I'm going to go out and wash my car. No. tell me about Wanted. I mean, since we paid lip service to the beginning of the show.
Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made. Oh, Jerry, you wanted to like it. So, yeah, I did. But I wanted to have fun. And guess what? I did have a lot of fun. It's so outlandish, so over the top. And I know it's the kind of film that if Chris went to go see, he'd be right here saying, Jerry, do you have any standards? But I really did. And I have to say something. And I did not say this in my review, but I'm going to say this right now. I think Angelina Jolie's casting, because she does not say much in the film, actually. If you go back and think about it, I think someone pointed out she maybe had 6 or 7 lines of dialogue.
That's fine by me.
That's fine by me, too. I think it's they finally found the perfect part for her.
Yeah.
Along the lines when Cameron, Cass, Schwarzenegger, and Terminator, they found to make him play the killing machine, the cyborg, it was like the biggest part, the best part for him at the time. And it's along those lines to a degree. But they really found a part for her to play that I thought really finally took advantage of everything that she is.
Right.
So I have to give them props for that.
Incredibly appealing cast, a director who, if nothing else, is extremely visual.
Very visual.
You know, it looks like an exciting ride.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get your thoughts on WALL-E, which has been, you know, universally praised, and it's amazing. You don't hear this with any other type of film. Maybe you heard it with There Will Be Blood, but every Pixar movie that comes out, Every review says instant classic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how much of a streak is Pixar on? I mean, this is unfathomable, and it all has to do. I'm sure you'll agree. It all has to do more than anything else with story. I mean, they just have story down.
You're absolutely right. And the only, you know, speaking of Pixar, the only film I was not crazy about, while visually it was neat, was Cars. I could never get into Cars, but you can't deny the visual genius behind that film. It's a beautiful film. But otherwise, Pixar is just incredible. But this film, Jamie, what's incredible about this film is, you know, you go in, I loved Ratatouille. I mean, I thought Ratatouille was just incredible.
Right.
You know, we take it for granted about Pixar, but this film was just, I have not been that emotionally involved in one of their films.
And like, you think about how impossible it seems on the outset.
Yeah.
If you think about that's why they're so damn good with story.
Yeah.
Because you look at the plot of Ratatouille, and you're thinking, how is that going to work? You look at the plot of WALL-E, which I've heard is played mostly as a silent film almost.
For the most part, yes.
Yeah, and you're thinking, how is that going to work?
Yeah.
And yes, they make it work.
And you're watching this, and halfway through, you know, you're like, it's like E.T. It's very magical. I have to say that. It is very magical, like E.T. You're watching and you can't believe yourself. You want to almost pinch yourself. You're like, am I really getting that into this? I'm more emotionally involved in this than most of the other stuff I've seen this year with, like, live action, you know. and you just can't get over how you forget you're watching an animated movie almost.
Yeah.
It's that good.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, well, wanted to mention, it did very well this weekend, obviously.
Yes.
It opened number one with Wanted very close behind, surprisingly close.
Yeah, I saw that,
behind.
Yeah.
So, but there's also a big buzz this week because the first reviews of the new Batman film have surfaced.
I'm very jealous of all these people who have seen it so far. Very jealous.
And we will we'll discuss that in just a bit. So I think our next guest is on the line.
Okay.
I'm hoping this is his number because I'm about to do the intro. So let's do this. This is an incredibly special segment for me. I remember seeing this film earlier this year at Sarasota Film Festival, and he was actually attending, the filmmaker. And you know, after it ended, I had to step away for about 20 or so minutes to sob, so I could I could approach him confidently and get my words out. Would you like to do my show? An amazing film. We move on to this year's most heartbreaking, haunting, and cathartic cinematic experience. Dear Zachary is a masterpiece of a documentary from writer-director Kurt Kenney. The film has been playing to festival audiences all across the country. Here is a trailer for that film.
Charismatic.
Opinionated.
Really a good storyteller.
He had a presence.
He had the worst possible dad.
He's going to be a great doctor.
Well, the phrase I was going to use had been full of life.
Do you know who that is?
Andrew. I had to get killed.
Because somebody hurt him, buddy.
I'm an only child, and I'll get around to why this is of any importance whatsoever.
When I had to say, was my son murdered? And take that into your soul. And then to know how cold-bloodedly he was murdered.
Who murdered him?
A very bad person.
Which bad person? A lady?
Mm-hmm.
Or she just killed him.
Andrew wanted to go on with his life, and he wanted to break up with her. Oh, she said, that's it then. She was dumped again.
Unfortunately, she made it to Canada before they could arrest her.
On the afternoon of November 7th, 2001, my sister called to tell me that Dr. Andrew Bagby, my closest friend since the age of 7, had been killed. My name's Kurt, and I'm a filmmaker. Andrew appeared in every movie I made growing up.
Jesus Christ, Kurt, what do you want? I mean,
I decided to make a movie, to travel far and wide, to interview everyone who ever knew and loved Andrew. But I never could have guessed what would happen next.
Kurt, I just got a call from Mrs. Bagby. The abbreviated version is, what's your bucket, that bitch? Held a press conference and announced that she's 4 months pregnant with Andrew's baby. They can't prove it until the child's born. If it is true that Bagby's are going to sue for custody.
She named the little boy Zachary. To seek custody of the only grandson they would ever have, Andrew's parents, Kate and David Bagby, moved to St. John's, Newfoundland, where Shirley Turner was unbelievably allowed to walk free on bail while awaiting extradition, and had custody of the baby. She called the shots because the government allowed her to hold the hostage. In order to see Zachary, Kate and David were forced to stomach a civil relationship with the woman they knew had murdered their only son.
Hello?
Hello, Shirley.
Hi.
David.
Yeah.
How's Zachary?
Good.
I now had a mission. My movie might be one of the only ways Zachary could see and get to know his father. So I vowed to collect every memory for him before they were gone. So I grabbed a digital video camera, a 16mm wind-up movie camera, and an old Nikon, pointed the van east toward Newfoundland, and set off on a quest to bring a man back to life.
Someday you will realize how brave and courageous your grandparents are.
Please welcome to the show director Kurt Kenney. Let me bring up his line here. Kurt, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just great. Thank you, man, for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Brad.
No problem. I'm honored to have you on the show. So tell me a little bit about, you know, you had said that Andrews was featured in every movie you made as a kid. Do you feel like filmmaking was in your blood, like you always wanted to be a filmmaker, you always knew that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Pretty much everyone I went to film school with at USC, sounds like a cliche, we had the same answer. Why did you want to be a filmmaker? It's like, well, I saw Star Wars and I wanted to make movies. Yeah, so when I was about 4, I saw Star Wars and said, I want to do that, and I just started doing it whatever way I had access to. First, I would grab my dad's Super 8 camera, and then I got a paper out and saved up my money and bought, you know, the best sort of VHS camera equipment and, you know, editing decks that were available at the time, and just started doing it. And I kept all the raw footage tapes from everything I ever shot, and which I remember my mom was always, you know, yelling at me, why don't you get rid of those things? They're taking up space in the closet and everything. I said, no, you never know, I might need them someday. And then after Andrew was killed, I was like, see, aren't you glad I didn't throw these out now?
Oh, they're invaluable.
Yeah, because it's, you know, I have basically an archive of his entire, you know, from youth to adulthood.
Yeah.
And the great thing is, unlike shooting film, where because it's so expensive, you would cut after every take, with video, you leave it rolling. So to me, the most valuable parts were all the stuff between the takes when he was just being himself, because you had him, you know what I mean? So, and that's the stuff I was able to kind of mine and use for this movie as well, which kind of, you know, served in kind of, you know, evoking who he really was, I think.
Absolutely.
As opposed to what I was telling him to do in the old films.
Yeah. But when you'd made several films before this, hadn't you? You'd made several documentaries, right?
I've made one documentary before this called Drive-In Movie Memories that has been on PBS a fair amount over the last few years. It's about the
film, okay.
Yeah, it's about the history of drive-in movie theaters.
Right.
Leonard Maltin and Barry Corbin and whatnot.
It's a good one. That's great. I love that one.
Thank you. Yeah, it's that's more in the vein of the kind of vibe of movie that I usually try to do, which is more fun.
funny
and fast-paced. I'm principally actually consider myself more of a fiction filmmaker. A documentary was something I sort of got into by accident. And I tend toward the more comedic in my fiction work as well. I made a teen drama called Scrapbook right out of USC, which was my first feature several years ago with Eric Balfour. Then I have a series of short film comedies that I've been making over the past few years that are, you know, playing any number of festivals at any given time throughout the year. They've been in circulation for a couple of years. I keep doing a new installment, and they keep coming out to the circuit. So, and I'm about to do another fiction feature here early next year, more comedic in nature. I need something funny after finishing this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I understand how, I can't imagine how kind of bittersweet and kind of painful this process has to be. I mean, we want as many people as possible to see this film. It is the most moving film, one of the most moving films I've ever seen.
Well, thank you.
And it's powerful work. But tell me about Andrew and your relationship with him.
He was a fun guy. I mean, what kind of encapsulates it is there's a little segment in the movie where I allude to it just because I got so many people saying it on camera, that he's the only person I've ever met who was asked by at least 7 or 8 different people to be best man at their wedding. Several of those he did get to do while he was still alive, and then others, you know, they wanted to ask him to do it, and then he had passed before that happened. He was the kind of guy who, when he came into a room, like the party kind of started, he kind of lit up, and he was conscious of it or would ever admit it, but he was like one of the most fascinating, like, storytellers, like, if you know, at a social occasion that I've ever seen, just who could kind of spin the room and, you know, everyone would stop talking and he'd be telling the story and he'd have everybody on the floor just cracking up. And I had some footage of him doing that I tried to put in the movie here or there, although it kind of pains me that the best storytelling that I ever saw him do was never captured on tape, so I don't quite, it has to live in my memory, it isn't quite in the movie, but
right.
I had at least some fairly close facsimiles that managed to get in there here and there.
So, when you heard about his murder and you set off to make this film about who Andrew was to everyone in his life, this had to have been just a project for you and those people in his life. It had to have been kind of you weren't thinking about necessarily a project for distribution. This seemed like something more personal.
Exactly. Yeah. No. I decided I wanted to do something within about 24 hours of getting the news that he'd been killed, just because I felt like it was my responsibility, because I'm the only one of his friends who was a filmmaker. I had all of this material that I knew everyone else in his life would want to have as a keepsake.
Yeah.
So, and then plus I also realized I'm never going to get to go visit him at his hospital and see what he's like as a doctor. I'm never going to meet all these people I've been hearing him talk about in his life that are his relatives off in these, you know, various far-flung locales and people he'd worked with and gone to med school with. I'd always assumed I'd get to meet these people someday. I realized, wow, he's not going to be around to have, like, get-togethers like weddings and things. You know, I mean, I met some of them at the funeral, but it's like, is that it? You know, and so I kind of concocted shooting this documentary as sort of my way to get to go visit him, quote-unquote, one last time, to go travel around, you know, the continent and to other countries and meet these people and have an excuse to go hang out with them by way of interviewing them. So it was kind of just almost a personal cathartic grieving process for me, and I knew I was putting something together for that family and friends would enjoy. And there have been two scholarship funds set up in his memory, one at his hospital where he was practicing when he passed and the other at his medical school. And when I was in film school, I received a scholarship from the family of Harold Lloyd, and Harold Lloyd's family came out and met me and gave me a documentary about him, and that always meant a lot to me, that I felt like I was being included in what this award meant and the tradition thereof, and I wanted to be able to do the same thing for the people who are receiving Andrew's scholarship. So originally, yeah, this was just something I was putting together for family, friends, scholarship fund recipients, and I figured, you know, that would be it. Then 4 months after his murder, it became clear that the woman who killed him was pregnant with his child, and suddenly I realized this isn't just something I'm doing for me and family and friends. I have a real responsibility here, because this could be basically the only way that the little guy is going to get to meet his father at some point. And so I sort of realized this is you don't have a choice here. This is your responsibility.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, but still, it was only intended to be just for him and family and friends and whatnot. It was only when probably shouldn't say too much for people who haven't seen the film, but it's only when the second tragedy that occurs in the film happened that
it demands to be a crusade at that point. Yeah.
So, and because originally some people had talked to me about it, I actually met other documentary filmmakers who like had seen my previous documentary, and they'd, you know, we were hanging out talking, and they kept saying the emotional dynamic here is so insane. You've got to put this out for the public, and I said no, I won't do that. That's exploitative. But you know, and so I was adamant that I wasn't going to release this publicly. But you know, when you know, like I said, a second crime happened that was totally preventable, I decided that was absolutely necessary to tell the story to the world in the most, what I hoped was the most effective manner possible, to try to get laws changed. Specifically bail laws up in Canada. So
let's talk about this the initial part of your movie here. Andrew had been dating this woman that became more and more possessive.
Mm-hmm.
And she murdered Andrew. At what point was she extradited to Canada? When did that happen?
Well, she committed the crime. She killed him in Pennsylvania. Then within a week of that, she fled to Canada. She had dual citizenship in the United States and Canada, so the passage was rather easy to do. And the police didn't have the Pennsylvania police didn't have the entire case against her in place until a little over a week after she left. And they can't charge the person until they have all the evidence in one place. So she managed to get out before they were able to get all the evidence together, some of which was her cell phone records, which are just very difficult to get a hold of in a timely fashion when you're talking about establishing a travel pattern over a period of space, you know, like in this case about a 1,600-mile drive.
Right.
That proved where she was at the time of the murder. So she fled to Canada, and then they spent about a year and a half trying to get her back to the United States, and the, you know, the hearings just dragged on forever and ever. But the biggest issue during this period was that even though she was charged with first-degree murder and criminal homicide, Canada let her walk free on bail the entire time, putting everyone around her at completely unnecessary risk. If she'd never made it out of Pennsylvania, she would have been behind bars awaiting trial because of the nature of the charges and the crime that she was accused of.
And it's interesting the thinking behind letting her go free. Wasn't it something that the judge said something to the effect of, you know, this was only a one-time thing, Andrew was the only one that she wanted to do harm to, and she did it, so it's out of her system, essentially, isn't...
Yeah, the logic used to make that decision was not one that I could follow, or anyone that I know can possibly follow. And well, she was actually let out on bail twice, because they did incarcerate her for like a quick month and a half, 2 month period, and then they let her right back out again. And the first time, actually, the prosecution, the Crown prosecutor in Canada, didn't even put up an argument. He came in with a deal on the table for her to walk free. So I think she spent a whole, you know, a whole maybe of 2 or 3 hours under arrest or something like that. I can't remember the specifics, but on the first time. So it's there's the general sense that I get is a lack of understanding of the grave danger that a accused probable premeditated murderer poses. And in this case, I mean, like I said, don't want to say too much for people who haven't seen it, but they let her out and she committed a second murder, so which is totally preventable. And that's the whole reason that I decided to craft a version of this movie for a general audience to promote discussion about this topic, and I hope legal change sometime in our future here.
Please forgive me if I missed something that you said. This doesn't boil down to the bad judgment of a judge. It has to do with the law itself.
No, because judges don't have to answer to anyone except the higher authority, the Supreme Court. They don't have to answer to the people for their decisions or whatever. And technically under the law, those judges had every right to make those decisions because the law allows those decisions to be made. Now, I and everyone else I know who's looked at this question why, certainly question the wisdom of those decisions, but if a law was in place that sort of, protected, people from making, moronic, leaps of logic like that, that wouldn't allow things like that to happen, then this, the discussion wouldn't even be an issue. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
So Andrew's father wrote a book about this called Dance with the Devil, which is sort of his point of view telling of this whole experience. And then the last section of the book is his very, very, I think, well-detailed and thought-out argument of a proposal for change to bail law and, denying bail to people accused of first-degree murder.
And all of those listening to the show, you'll see the cover of that book on the page that you're on. If you click on that, it'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase the book. I wanted to know about, was this just you? Was it essentially a crew of one when you set out to put this together?
Yeah, the whole movie was just me, basically. I'm a composer as well, too. I wrote the score, I did the sound design, I was my own cameraman, and I did my own color correction as well, too. So it was a one-person thing from the beginning. And that's actually the same exact way I made Drive-In Movie Memories as well, too. And at that time, it was done just to save money, and I found I really liked working that way. And for this particular project, it would have been really weird to have a second person along anyway, because it was really more my, journey of traveling around, talking to people. So fortunately, I had plenty of practice being my own crew in the past so that it wasn't any big deal to do it and hopefully have the production values not suffer as a result.
And this is just an observation on my part. I mean, God bless you for doing it. That it is that personal to you, because I was thinking that this is the kind of story that you'd see on a Dateline. A tabloid news would get a hold of it. And the fact that you are so close to the story, the audience just feels it down in their bones. I mean, it becomes very personal to the audience as well. The distance isn't necessarily there, which it's a remarkable film. And what's most remarkable about the film is the portrait of Andrew's parents, the Bagbys. Tell me about their journey. And I mean, it's incredibly difficult. They had to befriend the woman that they knew murdered their son so they could spend time with their grandchild. And after all this turmoil, what keeps them going?
I maybe wouldn't use the word befriend just because they had to be civil with her to have access to the kids, so they had to make nice. But they by no means enjoyed that process.
That's sorry.
I know what you. But I know what you mean. That describes the vibe of what was going on. Andrew's dad says, what drives him is just rage that this was allowed to happen, that this shouldn't have happened. And he said, I'm on a mission to get laws changed, and that's what gets me out of bed every morning. He said, in a way, I'm quote-unquote lucky as murder victims go because I have a place to focus my anger and something I can do. He said, so that I know is what he says gets him out of bed every morning and keeps him, you know, going is the thought that he can do something positive. What I tried to instill in them from the moment that Andrew was killed and that I reiterated in the movie and that I, you know, hope they continue to think about is the fact that there was like a whole group of us that grew up with Andrew from like first grade on who kind of half the time grew up in their house under their roof, and they really were like second parents to the rest of us. So even though Andrew was an only child, they really still do have a whole mess of living children here, of which I count myself as one. And there's, you know, probably at least a dozen of us who would claim that status, I think. So I think having all that kind of extended family around them in a really powerful way has really helped a lot too. Because as with Andrew, they have probably more friends than almost anybody I know too. Just the number of people who just want to keep in touch with them and help them out and know what's happening in their lives is, you know, just pretty staggering.
Yeah.
So I regardless of the fact that so much has been taken from them in their immediate family, that they do have an enormous amount of great support network surrounding them just through, you know, non-blood relations, if you will.
Yeah, it's just remarkable people and so inspiring, and it really represents, you know, the best of us. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
sure.
So much of your film, I mean, it portrays the worst in human nature and the very best in human nature. I'm wondering, you are an absolutely stunning filmmaker, and this watching this film, and you talked about editing, and then you composed the music yourself, which is very moving. And there's moments, particularly in the editing, where it becomes very cinematic, but not in a way that draws you out of the reality of what you're seeing. And I know people that when they watch it, they'll know what I'm saying.
Sure.
Were you tinkering with that? Was that something that you weren't sure you wanted to play with? Those kind of editing effects?
That's just kind of my style. I've just kind of been cutting like that for years. It's interesting because sometimes it does seem to attract people's attention. It's not really something I'm doing to attract attention per se. It's more just the way I see things. And particularly in this case, the way that I cut the film together, color time to, you know, use the sound design and the music, it was all basically my best attempt to, you know, give you emotionally what was going on inside of my head at the time. And
yeah.
Just sort of the, you know, when the pace gets really frenetic and the cutting goes kind of insane, as with the soundtrack and everything, I'm just trying to more mirror what was going on in my head and what I think was going on in Andrew's parents' head as well, too, and just the feeling of, you know, like when you get certain pieces of news, just the complete disorientation that happens and other things too. It just was basically my best attempt to convey to you how I experienced it emotionally. It's up to each person to say whether or not they think that works, but that was what I was doing.
Oh, I think it works like gangbusters. And right. What strikes me is that usually when it comes to documentaries, you think about maybe this is one of the lessons that they teach you when you put together a documentary. Don't infer a particular, you know, a style onto it necessarily. Like, you always think documentaries as being objective kind of experiences, and that's why it surprised me that you went that way with it. But it works completely, just like you said.
Well, I thought the only reason that this movie, you know, was maybe worth a damn, you know, in the public eye is because I had a very, very strong point of view on what happened here, and I tried to be as even-handed as I could with it, given my place in the whole thing. But at the same time, I really think that what happened here was atrocious, and I don't backpedal in saying so. And,
right, right.
And so, I mean, you can take it for what it's worth. It's my, my point of view. There was one critic I read who really made me happy to see that she saw this. That she said it's not hard to see where my bias enters into it, but it's also not hard to see the facts underneath and how I'm, you know, fairly justified in saying what I'm saying, hopefully. So
Yeah, well, I'm on your side here, but absolutely. You're now this movie it's just been picked up, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. That's one of the things. Like when we met in Sarasota, the negotiations were going on, but I wasn't allowed to talk about it until the whole
right.
thing was signed, which it finally was. So it's a relief to finally be able to say the words that yes, it has been picked up. MSNBC is starting a new sort of film documentary division called MSNBC Films, and they have picked this up to sort of be the initial launch of that.
Cool.
Which is pretty cool. So it's definitely going to be on MSNBC sometime after November 1st. They are going to start it in rotation thereafter, and it's going to have some form of a theatrical prior to that. I know we're screening in Los Angeles and New York in August for our Academy qualifying run. We may have more of a theatrical run after that. That's still being negotiated. I honestly don't know the details of right now. My sales rep is working all that out. So it's hopeful that there will be some more theatrical play between that, but regardless, it will be on MSNBC sometime around November, December of this year.
Awesome. And you guys recently had a premiere in Canada, and then the Bagbys actually attended, didn't they?
Yes. They've attended as many screenings as they can. They didn't come. The two that they didn't attend were South by Southwest and Sarasota, I think just because they were getting kind of tired of traveling, so they decided to hold off and go to Canada.
But Canada was the important, I mean, that was the crucial screening.
Yeah, so that was, we had our Canadian premiere at Hot Docs in Toronto the end of April. And, so all of us went out for that, and that was a really wonderful experience. We were a little nervous coming into it because I'd been nervous because, you know, I'm an American, and I didn't want it perceived as, oh, this American coming in and saying, you know, judging our, you know, judicial process. I was more trying to tell this is what happened to me. And as Andrew's father says all the time, this isn't a nationalistic issue. If, you know, murder is walking free to do it again is wrong wherever it happens, and
mm-hmm.
it does happen in the United States and certain states as well, too. So I'm hoping, you know, anywhere that is still allowed, that hopefully they'll take a look at this movie and maybe make them think about that issue. But yeah, the Canadian audiences just were wonderful. They gave both screenings like a 2-minute plus standing ovation. I announced at that time that right before I'd come to Canada, I'd sent letters to all 400 plus members of Canadian Parliament requesting the opportunity to screen the film for them. When I announced that, the whole theater just burst into applause again. So they seem to really support the idea of their legislators taking a look at this. So I've started corresponding with some people on Parliament Hill, and we're trying to work to set up a screening for them sometime this fall when their sessions reconvene. So we'll see what happens. I'll definitely keep you posted. So
yeah, I would love that. And would you recommend to our listeners that they visit your website for more information?
Absolutely, yeah. And my email is on there, too. If you click on contact, if you want to be added to the email list for updates or whatever, just let me know, and I'll add you to the updates so you can know when it's available to be seen and when it's
okay.
When it's playing theatrically, when it's going to be on television, when it'll be on DVD, all that sort of thing.
Is that website DearZachary.com? Or?
Oh, yeah, DearZachary.com, all one word. So
okay,
Zachary being spelled Zachary.
Okay, we will put that in the chat room. So is there something coming up next for you?
Last fall I signed an option with a financing company out of Romania to direct a script for which I won the Nickel Fellowships in Screenwriting from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences a few years back.
Wow.
It's a script I've had bouncing around town for a while that I've been attached to direct. And, you know, when you're attached to direct, it always makes things more difficult, but I knew I wanted to do it and finally found a home that, you know, with people that I really, really creatively just click with. So hopefully we'll be shooting that in the spring. I'm not sure if we're going to be shooting in Romania or in the United States. That's still being worked out. But it's much more comedic in nature also, too, thank God.
Well, you're welcome back on our show anytime you want.
Well,
future projects, anything you want to talk about, come right back to us. Okay, my friend?
Well, thanks so much. Thanks for having me on and for the support. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
No problem.
God bless and have a great evening.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Kurt Kinney, director of Dear Zachary, and the website, we'll put that up in the chat room.
Oh, I did. It's there.
Okay. Thank you, man. Fantastic film. If it plays anywhere near you, go see it. It is almost, you know, I dare say life-changing. I mean, it really gets you down to the core.
No, it sounds that way. It definitely sounds that way. I did not know that the MSNBC was going to do had that, so that's incredible.
That's their flagship movie right there.
Yeah.
They're launching the whole thing on right there.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about a little bit. Let's light it up by talking about something dark, The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
The reviews have started pouring in. I think Peter Travers beat everyone to the punch from Rolling Stone. That was a major get, a major coup. He was probably typing up his review as he was watching it.
Yeah, I think so. I was shocked because I had called you, I think, and told you that
yeah.
I had read it. It was online already, and it's just like we have, you know, still like 3 weeks to go, I think. So,
yeah, very well written review too. Yeah, but it's, you know, it's coming. It feels like it's coming right around the corner. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Are you going to watch it in IMAX? Are you going to wait to see it in IMAX?
No, I'm going to I just want to see it because I'm not, because we'll never get into IMAX. It's like one theater downtown, and I mean, I would make the effort to see it after I've seen. I would like to just first see it, and then I'll go see it in IMAX. But I'm not going to make a special trip. I just want to see this thing already.
I am going to make a special trip. I mean, our IMAX screen is 45 minutes out of town, and knowing what a visionary Nolan is, and that
mm-hmm.
parts of this were shot specifically for IMAX, I can't wait to take on that experience. The only thing is, the last Batman that he did, the Batman Begins, I watched in IMAX. I didn't get there early enough. I was sitting in the front row. You can't do that, man.
Yeah, you can't. See, that's I just get too worked up. I'd have to get there, like, the morning of that to wait in line. And I just
that's
don't.
Just it. What I watched Shine a Light IMAX, the same theater. I was seated in the back. Beautiful experience.
Yeah.
I need to take a lesson from myself and get there early.
Yeah.
But by all accounts, the reviews, fan-freaking-tastic.
Yeah. I don't know what to say at this point except to just watch it. I mean, there's going to be a lot of. It seems like he's made a truly epic film. Not just a comic book movie, and that's what I thought about. That's what I loved about Batman Begins so much. He took this comic book character, or comic book characters, but put them in a real world setting.
Right.
He really, what he did was, and it sounds like what he's done again, is quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Just can't wait.
I love his take on the Joker, too.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that obviously Heath Ledger shared. It's just an anarchist. He just, and like the line in the movie, he just wants to see the world burn.
Mm-hmm.
And as somebody like Batman, if we approach this realistically, how do you grapple with something like
mm-hmm.
that? You know, it's very interesting. I've been seeing some interviews with the talent involved too. It's always amazing because we're used to seeing Christian Bale in some of these roles, and then he's interviewed and his Australian accent comes out and.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wow, is he putting on a... You realize it's his normal accent. It's a
yeah,
little
yeah.
offsetting. But he said, you know, Batman's out of place in this movie. You know, he's growing. He's tired of being the superhero. And these are things that Tim Burton kind of hinted at but didn't explore.
Right.
You know, he wants to throw down his mantle to the law enforcement, you know.
Aaron Eckhart's character, Harvey Dent. And it sounds
yeah.
like Aaron Eckhart might be the first actor... Now, I'm taking into consideration not just Tommy Lee Jones, but also the actor who played him on the Adam West show. I'm just using that. But Aaron Eckhart seems to be the first actor to play this in a way that fits perfectly within Nolan's world. It's not cartoonish at all.
It's tragic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the only complaint I have is the same complaint I had about one of the last trailers that I said for a split second. They showed you what I thought was the turning point of the movie, what was supposed to be the big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it more explicitly in the TV commercials.
They are.
They're even going as far as, like, going way far to almost reveal it in some of these reviews. And then they kind of back up. But, you know, anybody with half a brain can add it together. And but that bothers me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. It's very surprising. Because in that first trailer they showed that came out in December... They don't show you anything, really. And then the second trailer, it's like, did someone proof this trailer? Did someone, like, you know, are you aware of what you're showing?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Unbelievable.
On the TV commercials, it's very explicit. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
scene is right there.
Yeah, mm-hmm, it is.
Yeah. Mmm.
I know. I'm just very excited. That's the big film. I mean, not only for the summer, but really one of the big films of the year, I think.
Yeah, yeah. 2.5 hours of goodness. Apparently,
yeah.
It's 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, it's that and Tropic Thunder for me. Through, you know.
For, I'm with you there. I'm with you.
I haven't really looked at the fall lineup very closely.
There are a couple of interesting things that we've talked about. I think actually two are World War II themed. The Spike Lee Miracle at Santa Ana and the Daniel Craig one, Defiance, plus the new Bond film and the Eastwood film. But I don't... There's some stuff at the end of the... There's a
new
Harry
Coen
Potter...
The new Coen Brothers film.
That's the big one. That's big. And it looks funny.
Yeah.
We saw a trailer for that yesterday, and it's hilarious.
That's going to be hysterical. I just want to see Malkovich in a Coen Brothers film. I just like that dynamic.
The time has come, no doubt.
Absolutely. This Wednesday, we got a great show. The author of Producing with Passion, Tony Lavelle, and the creator of The X-Files and the director of the upcoming X-Files 2, I Want to Believe.
Right.
Comes out July 25th, I believe. Chris Carter will be here. Chris Carter is a pre-recorded interview, and so I've already posted up on all the X-Files blogs and fan clubs. If you have a question for Mr. Carter, submit them to us. MovieGeeksUnited@yahoo.com or through our MySpace page. I've already been flooded with questions from like Scotland and all over the world. So
I'm just curious, what kind of questions are you getting? If you can reveal them, anything interesting? Or
yeah, I'll be revealing them Wednesday.
Okay, all right. I'm just curious. Are you getting a lot of questions about the last two seasons of the show? Or
I'm getting questions about the movie mostly, and
okay,
and the whole secrecy of the movie and. Some of them are cool questions.
Good.
I'm not gonna ask something like, "How does the movie end?"
No, or what was that one question? Or what is the movie all action? Or is this a boring part?
Yeah, right. I'm so nervous to talk. Is your movie like really boring, and then it picks up? Is that? Yeah,
that
exactly.
Crazy stuff.
That's what my movie is. It's real boring, and then it picks up. Go see it.
Yeah.
All right, guys, it's been a lot of fun. We'll see you back here Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. We got some exciting things coming up at the end of the month. I'll mention one right now. We have the first of a three-part tribute to Steven Spielberg
coming up
at the end of the month. It's going to be exciting. And we will see you on Wednesday night. Jerry, thanks so much.
Thank you. And everyone, thanks for tuning in, and we will talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.